eyes. These were our babies, and he had only love and cheer to offer them. And it was such a contrast to what he felt for me. I had to walk away and leave him to invent an excuse for Mummy. I could not have pretended happiness. I would have cried to hear their lovely voices, so I turned my back and hid myself amongst the people looking up numbers in interstate directories. If I opened the Adelaide directory, it was only by chance. Of course, I was pretending, and I looked up the only name I knew in Adelaide. And there he was, Buck Hooper the pastor. And I did not have a pen, so I just tore out the page and shoved it in my handbag. Our car was on the front page of the Perth West Australian. Just the same, I did not feel like I was winning anything, and when we pushed west to the town of Coolgardie, the small city of Kalgoorlie, we were not the first cars in the pack, but we were still ahead by points, and when we arrived at Lonely Norseman at 4 in the morning, we found its single street crowded and the shops all ablaze, and I hated how people smiled at us and waved. They had stayed up all night to see us. It was wrong to hate them for grinning at the ruination of a family.
"Get used to it," my husband said. "This is the future."
I did not trust him anymore. I thought, he will divorce me once we get back home. For what? For nothing. When a flashbulb popped, it seemed as if his face popped back at it, and he would be luminous with popularity all the way to Sydney. I would not get used to it, and I was outraged that he should trust vile Dunstan, who had obviously filled his head with lies. I wished I'd been guilty of adultery. I might have had some fun. Peeing on the desolate Nullarbor, no sign of human life, I heard a jet plane high above the clouds. I imagined Willie was in it. He would not laugh at what I felt. On we went, and on, Titch and I shouting at each other above the roaring exhaust, digging ourselves deeper when all we wanted to do was climb out of the hole we'd made. We drove through bright moonlight, with windows closed uselessly against the limestone dust, which drifted like smoke through the gnarled scrub and hurt our eyes and nostrils. Our feelings were like things previously unknown to us, moaning from beneath the road itself. I peed again. I took the wheel. "Am I a partner?" I asked him. My boots were splashed, and I felt disgusting and unlovely.
"You were meant to be my wife," he answered.
"Meant to," I noted. "Yes, but not your partner."
"Say what you mean, Irene. We put some money in a syndicate, okay?"
"Whose money?"
"The odds were long," he said.
"Who else is in this syndicate? It's those Ballarat geezers, isn't it? Joe Thacker? And that man, the bookmaker?" This was a dumb guess, and I was frightened to see that it was right.
"You notice I'm not asking you questions."
"Ask away."
"I wouldn't lower myself."
"Perhaps you should." We passed the Vanguard Spacemaster, abandoned, lonely in the headlights, wrapped around a grid post. A mile later, we got our third puncture, and it was all hands on deck. The wind whipped the sand into my eyes, and I thought, if Australia had a bottom, this would be the place it did its business. Of course, Titch never thought like that.
"There must be something can be done with this," he had said earlier.
He meant the Nullarbor, that there must be something useful to be done with this sand, this gnarled and stunted scrub, Mile and Mallee and Mulga.
"With careful and sympathetic organization," he said.
If I was irritated, I tried not to show it. This was how he looked at everything, and I had loved him for it. Ceduna is a small fishing town, 2,300 miles from Broome, 1,200 miles from Perth, 500 miles from Adelaide. There were few garages, and everyone was full of trial wrecks, including Wally Bishop's Plymouth, which had been in second place. No one could fix our exhaust. As we left Ceduna, the rain began to fall, and I thought, thank goodness, that will lay the dust. But the road was soon a slippery mess, and the rain was beating in gusts against the car. At dawn, we passed miserable groups of poor blacks, families wearing rags the color of cement. We were so tired, sleeping half an hour, driving half an hour.
"Don't muck this up," he said.
I thought, what does he think has happened to us? Who will live next door in Bacchus Marsh? The city of Adelaide seemed so perfect, it might have been dry-cleaned. We were 2 hours ahead of time and found a garage in Klemzig to do the muffler and perform a grease and oil change. I removed the Admona box from the back seat and felt my husband's eyes upon me.
"Where do you think you're going?"
"Ah," I thought, "you're frightened." "Seeing a man about a dog," I said, and he stood by the petrol bowser with his mouth open and watched as I hailed a taxi. "Boom, boom," I thought, "to you." Of course, the driver was excited to have a Red X driver in the car, not least because he recognized me. "Mrs. Titch," he said, but fortunately he had very little curiosity. What he wanted was to tell me about the 3/4 grind camshaft he was fitting to his car at home. Then this was Paynham, where, as I would soon learn, Willie had loved the girl. At the back of these simple suburban cottages, between the Italian market gardens and this house from the phone book, with its screened-in sleep-out and its flower bed, and two long strips of concrete, at the end of which an old Ford Prefect rested undisturbed. I could not say exactly why I was so pleased, but I knew I could take my little boy here, and he would be well treated. I did not know what it meant to me, but when I finally walked down those double concrete paths beside the hydrangeas and saw the old pastor with his high, wiry grey hair and his round wire glasses and that long and solemn chin, when I saw he was carrying mandarins in his hat, I trusted him completely.
Chapter 2. My sunburned driver was like a long-legged bird, forever poking at whatever worm or beetle passed his way. Perhaps he would turn out to be a character, or perhaps he would end up being a bore. But until we passed the roadhouse, he had seemed curious and garrulous, ingenuous, provincial, friendly, and it did not occur to me that I should fear him. "I'm not the navigator," he said. "That was meant to be your game. Can you take me back, please?" He licked his lips, and I thought of a dog, nervous, withdrawing from a fight. "I live in the here and now," he said. "But where are you?" "I've got business in Perth." "Relax. You're too young for business. You're in the here and now. What's that over there?" "You mean those hills? Could you slow down, please?" "What you're calling those hills are ancient coral reefs. That's your now. You're not even seeing." "Compared to this," said Garrett Hanger, revealing sincere and agitated eyes, "Perth is nothing. You would have been bored in a day. This is for you," he said more gently. "Here, have another lifesaver. There is nowhere like this down south." "Did you talk to any human beings while you were in Broome?" Irene Bobbs would not have tolerated him, not Clover either. "An old Chinaman," I said. "Well, how many old Chinamen did you know before?" he said, surging forward, laying a great plume of yellow dust across the dreary scrub behind. "He told me the Indonesians had sailed their prahu to Broome for hundreds of years. They had caught beche de mer and smoked it on the beach. There were pearls and pearl shell. Japanese and Malays dived for it. The Chinamen traded it. The white fellows did all the usual business, which included clubs that excluded all the dusky brethren. So that gave birth to a certain sunshine club. I should listen to Seaman Dan." He slowed a fraction and then sped up. "Saturday night at the sunshine club, doing the waltz and the jitterbug," he sang. "Nothing like it anywhere. Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Sometimes they all live in one house together, men, women, children, all politely observing Ramadan and Christmas together. In Broome, they can see your family history in your nose and earlobes. My man, you're blushing. Did you have female company? Of course, the whites might be nervous of you. I beg your pardon? No one wants a throwback, do they? You mean a black child? I asked directly. There are beautiful mulattoes, he said urgently. They'll like you just to look at you. You'd be at home in Broome, blondy hair and all. You're a fetching young fella. They'll go for you. The fair hair goes down a charm. And anyway, the manager at Quamby Downs, you'll meet him presently. He's a blondie, pure merino, fresh from down south. Do you play cricket? Can you bowl? More of a spinner, I said. My mind was no longer in the car, but in Melbourne long ago, as I saw the pity in the eyes of Adelina's obstetrician. He'll love you, Garrett said. Who? Of course this one won't last. That type never do. But you get a good manager in place and everybody's happy. You'll be happy. There's 1,000,000 acres and 50,000 cattle. Where are we going? I asked, and he somehow understood I was defeated. You can travel for days and never leave the property, he said. The blackfellas will take you fishing and shooting. Lovely people. You'll help them get bush tucker. They'll be your friends forever. Have you got a camera? You should get a camera. You should teach them proper English. No pigeon in the classroom. But you'll love them. Fabulous kids. You won't believe the things you'll see. Ask them to show you Geikie Gorge. He did not tell me that the teacher at Quamby Downs Station had suffered a nervous breakdown. By now, the sun was at our backs as we wound in between the raw red bluffs that marked the entrance to the station, and I was a plump, ripe teacher, fresh from the south, someone readily acceptable to the sahibs in Perth. This is one of the biggest cattle stations in the world. To which you are delivering your stationery? That's it, chum. We threaded our way between red iron outcrops and emerged on a vast, overgrazed plain, dotted with ant hills and divided by a single brutal line of fence. Ahead was a lonely tree like a huge fat-bellied jug, and beneath it was parked a car, the fire-blackened corpse of a once familiar red-ex Peugeot, number 62. The back door swung open as we pulled up, and from the wreck emerged a passenger. Dr. Bloody Battery! Bloody hell! He limped to Garrett's open window and performed a mock salute. I heard you gone walkabout, my driver said. Dr. Battery crouched at the window, waving flies away, looking off into the distance. Back now, boss. You seen old cricket? The black man's grimace suggested this was not to be desired. Yeah, see that fella by and by. Maybe he let you fix my brakes. He say he shoot me next time. Maybe he growl, that fella. Captain Battery tipped his hat at me, and I thought, how can a limping man be here so soon? I thought of A.P. Elkin's clever men, who can run more than a foot above the ground. That is Mr. Buckhuber, the driver said. Battery gave no sign that we had any previous acquaintance. "He been go mad, that short one teacher," Dr. Battery said. "He in hospital." Garrett lifted his great nose, a movement precisely understood by Battery, who grinned. "This fella here, he been teaching?" "Hop up," Garrett said. "Maybe I see old cricket another time. Jump off when you like." The old fellow disappeared, and I did not understand that he was riding the rear bumper and holding the roof rack as we entered a site of abandoned trucks, untidy sheds, a bulldozer, some empty stockyards. He rode like a general inside a cloud of red dust, between the sorry iron buildings, past the workshop, cut into a knotted limestone bluff, through the shanties of a black's camp, between a line of women carrying kerosene drums on their heads. Having driven straight through a burned-out shed, and without having seen one of those 50,000 cattle, we arrived at the big house, a low, wide-roofed structure with walls of corrugated iron protected by a barbed-wire fence. Behind this barrier stood the manager of Quambi Downs, a blond-haired, sunburned farmer whose good looks were quite destroyed by his parrot nose. "Where the fuck have you been, you mongrel?" he said to our passenger. And of course he was Carter, nicknamed Cricket. He slapped his leg with a fly swatter. "We're in the middle of the muster. I've got the fucking chev out of order 3 fucking weeks. Lockie, mate, you can't do this. I had the cops out for you. Exemption or no exemption, you're lucky you aren't in the lock-up." I climbed out of the car with my airline bag, but although the manager had come out from his wired enclosure, he was not ready for me yet. "Mate, you can't just piss off when you feel like it."
"Sorry, boss."
"What are you doing now?"
"Need parts, boss. Fix up that chev."
"I got you, you bloody parts. We flew them in. They've been here 10 weeks. Where do you think you're going?"
"Talk that old chev."
"Chev's not down there."
"No, boss. This way."
So saying, he limped back along the rutted track, and the manager, with nothing to distract him, turned to meet me formally. "Who the fuck are you?"
"This is Mr. Buckhuber," said Garrett Hanger, "a schoolteacher straight from Melbourne." Carter beamed. He shook my hand and took my luggage and escorted me into his enclosure where, on his generous veranda, he introduced me to a slight, girlish woman, also blonde, who was watering a hanging plant. "Melbourne," he said by way of introduction.
"Mrs. Carter," she said.
We assembled in a wide, dark room smelling faintly of kerosene and the recent application of a damp mop. At its centre was a claw-legged table, presided over by a huge black chair studded with pearl shell. A large rectangle of grimy calico, a punker, was suspended above the table, and this swept continually back and forth, distributing the unappetizing smell of beef and fat. In the shadows stood its engine, a very black, fine-faced man pulling on a rope. From this individual's glittering eyes I shied away. I pulled up a pew, as instructed. The school inspector, for that is what the scoundrel was, produced a little something from his Gladstone bag, and the boss studied the bottle as if it were a rare and precious stamp. "Alice?" he bawled. "Alice?" In response, there appeared a much-laundered Aboriginal woman with a fortress face. She placed a glass before me, which I had no choice but to push away.
"Not for you, Buckhuber.
You're not going to be homesick for the opera, are you?"
"No.
The last fellow missed the opera," said Carter. And I saw the punker while I was listening closely. So I knew he had his hearing, unlike those fellows in the British Raj who were famously recruited from amongst the deaf.
"Poor bugger," said Carter. "Your predecessor was what you might call an idealist. Are you an idealist, Mr. Buckhuber?"
"No, it's okay. I'm not a monster. Of course, I blame the state of Western Australia, the curriculum, or whatever you want to call it. No one wants to teach these buggers anything practical. If the education department could see what Garrett sees, they'd change it. Garrett knows what I want, don't you, Garrett? Give me a kid at 12 and he'll be a working stock boy 2 years later."
"It's all right, mate. I won't kidnap them."
"We'll get on. I can get on with anybody. Of course, the grog is a problem here. They can't take it like a white man."
"So," I said, "I take it there is a position here."
"Don't worry," he said. "I'll show you the ropes. You've got to get to know the characters, the communists. There used to be 5 of them, but I took to shooting out their radiators. Not one of them has got a job himself, but there they are, riling up my people about getting paid. You know how many people I feed? 150.
The day I have to pay them, I'll kick the whole lot of them off the property. I felt the punkah-waller was the only one who guessed my resistance. At that time, I imagined him to be Tamil, with his sharp and slender nose. I sat at Carter's table in the gloom and darkness, and then the kerosene lamps arrived, and he carved a huge roast beef by the smoky yellow light. Two quiet, fair-haired children came to join us, but I was not told their names. Garrett sipped his good share of rum and allowed himself to defend the education department as he was expected to. "See, Mr. Backhuber," said Carter, "I can get along with anyone. Ask the missus. Tell them, Janet. My bark is worse than me bite." Mrs. Carter bestowed on me her weary smile, and I knew there was no force that could keep me captive in this hell. I would rise early and stay by the Morris Minor until the breaks were done.
Chapter 3. Perhaps it was the damage to my marriage that made me cry, or perhaps it was the tension of that endless Red X trial. More likely it was the frail old pastor, carrying his mandarins exactly as his son had once offered his welcome gift of eggs. He was Willie's father, and so, of course, he comforted me, his hand as light as a leaf upon my arm. "Dear lady," he relieved me of the cardboard box, "you clearly need a cup of tea." He turned without knowing who the hell I was. I followed. His figure was erect, narrow-shouldered, his gait a little rusty. I shuffled behind, down the concrete path, beside a powdery, sun-damaged Ford Prefect, then the compost heap, and then into a garage which had not seen a vehicle in many years. It had become a standard model dad shed, given over to carpentry and garden pots, and incubators and drying plants like rooster tails hanging from the rafters. He shifted a large wooden plane with his elbow and placed the Ardmona box on the workbench. What the heck was I to tell him? There was a wobbly card table and a stool and a kitchen chair. He gave me the chair and took the stool and poured black tea into a screw-on thermos cup. There was no sugar and no milk. "So?" he asked. When he saw I wished to open up my box, he produced a bone-handled pocket knife, old and yellowed, and cut the electrical tape my husband had used to bind it shut. Then I knew I must speak quickly. "I am Mrs. Bobbs," I said, "from Bacchus Marsh, near Melbourne." But the flaps were already open, and he saw. "I hoped you might give him a proper burial." His jaw was long, his lips compressed. I apologized.
"You came from Melbourne?"
"I know, but his own people will not touch him." He cupped his freckled hand over his mouth and chin.
"His people?"
"Aboriginal."
"And you are from Melbourne, but you have come here."
"I'm so sorry, Mr. Backhuber. I had no one else to ask. You see, we're in the Red X trial." This last was a mistake, leading only to confusion, which took some time to untangle. "I know your son," I said at last. He spoke sharply.
"Which son?"
"Willie."
"How can you know Willie?"
"Just days ago, in Broome." He looked stricken. "We're in a car race." He turned to the cardboard box and removed the skull from its bed of crumpled newspaper.
"But this," he said carefully, "this is a little child."
"Might we not bury him?" He did not answer immediately.
"You know our Willie."
Who, of any age, would not suffer confusion? He did not know me from Adam. He had never heard of Bacchus Marsh or his son's presence there. Did he even know Willie had turned into a teacher?
"Poor Willie," he said,
running his hand around that skull as smooth as an eggshell, hesitating at its hole.
"I did not serve you well, dear fellow."
His pale eyes wanted something from me, which I could not have named.
"It was an awful thing for a Christian to do. I think about it every day."
"I'm so sorry."
"Yes,"
he said impatiently. He had not wanted sympathy.
"But you see, he was so at home here, so contented, truly. He ran, oh, he ran, Mrs. Would you like to see his room?"
I couldn't spare the time, but yes, I must see the room. And the pastor was now very certain in his manner as he lowered the skull back into its nest. He closed the flaps and laid the wooden plane across the top. He then took my arm, not at all impatiently, and guided me out into the sunlight. It had rained not long before, and the drops were crystalline on his silver beat, and the new back steps of his cottage were bright and yellow. He need not have told me that his wife had died. The sad state of the kitchen, the little plastic bags hanging on doorknobs for the scraps, was enough to say I am on my own these days. He hurried me into a hall, and then a musty room where he raised the dark brown Holland blinds to reveal, like a faded photograph taken in the days before Kodachrome, a bare and tidy bedroom with tarnished athletic cups, a scuffed-up cricket ball, and three volumes of the children's cyclopedia, all arranged on long shelves above a tiny desk. A much-used teddy bear rested on the pillow, and on the wall above there was secured, with rusty, flat-headed drawing pins, a black and white picture of a castle. I supposed it was from a fairy tale, but frankly it gave me the heebie-jeebies. "Germany?" I asked.
"His castle on the Rhine."
I thought, where are his toys? The old man was already lowering the blinds.
"I did not trust him enough to tell him," he said. "And somehow he must have felt that, don't you think? He was sweet and affectionate, but he could not rely on our love. It's clear, isn't it? Why else would he run away with the girl? We would have loved her too, and all their babies, everyone."
The room was gloomy, but he showed no inclination to leave just yet.
"I could not tell him he was not our natural son."
"I see."
"No, I'm afraid you don't. He is Aboriginal. You see the problem, Mrs.
Bobs.
Mrs. Bobs, why would I bother him with that when he fitted in so well, in Adelaide? I thought I was sparing him, but then he gave the poor girl a black baby. What did he think? Where did he go? We saw her afterwards, but never him. All those years we loved him, cared for him, and at the same time we were white ants at the very foundations of his life. We were destroying him."
His eyes, startled, frightening, accusing. "I wish I had brought him back," I said, thinking how it might have been if he were still our beloved navigator. How different it might have been to see that pair united.
"Then what is that in the box, and why have you come to taunt me? I should have told him. I should have found his people for him. There was a letter inquiring, you know, from Madawara. Frankly, I could not see the point of it. He was a baby very badly treated, you know. When he came to us, he had a dreadful infection. He could have died, really. I thought, why trouble him with what he can't remember?"
"This was the injury to his shoulder."
"Ah, you know about that. He did not know what caused it. We invented a funny story."
"But then he had the child.
If only they had not run away. If I had been there. If only I'd been there. What a mess I've made."
He escorted me back to the house. My time was short. "Mr. Buckhuber, may I use your telephone?"
"I am retired from the ministry. When people need my counsel, they drop by."
And he smiled, and I realized I could not call a taxi. Back in the garage, he lifted the wooden plane from on top of the cardboard box.
"At least you leave me this."
I thought, oh dear, he is gaga. Mr. Buckhuber, this is not Willie.
How could it be Willie? This is a child.
Yes.
To be perfectly clear, Mrs. Bobbs from Bacchus Marsh, I cannot legally do anything for this poor fellow. We have no coroner's report, I assume. No death certificate. It's as if you found him by the road.
Yes.
We did horrendous things, you know that?
Yes.
Not only Germans, you understand?
Yes.
Do you know, Mrs. Bobbs, it often happened that a member of my parish would ask me to hold something, a letter, a little photograph, which they could not bear to throw away, but were worried their family might discover when they died. Many times I have taken these burdens.
Yes.
So I will hold yours.
But it's not the right thing.
There is no right thing, the old man said. There are just many, many wrong things, and sometimes we can do no better than pray to be forgiven.
In the shed he drank tea without remembering it had been poured for me.
You see, his son needs him, he said. His little boy is disconnected. The mother has married again, some American chap, a black man, I believe, what you would call a confirmed bachelor. Is that the right thing, or the best thing?
Mr. Buckhuber, I'm sorry. I have to leave. He did not reprimand me, but he cocked his head and frowned.
I do not have a phone, he said.
I know.
Yes, but wait. I have a number.
I waited. I could not be late. He messed around on his workbench amongst wood shavings and jars of nails and offcuts of timber. At last he took a carpenter's pencil and wrote with it on an offcut piece of tongue and groove.
If you have news of him, he said, the boy should have it, or his mother. This will find them.
I didn't want it. I had to take it. I should have stayed with him. I had to go. I kissed him, and I felt him go quite rigid. I'm sorry, I said, meaning for the unwanted kiss, for everything, my rudeness, my inability to stay. This was the guilty burden I carried with me up that concrete path, back to the empty streets of Paynham, where, finally, out of breath, in a panic, I walked into a service station. And there in the grubby office, its door smudged with greasy fingers, I found my picture on the wall, and a big, fat, oil-stained woman who was pleased to drive me to the starting line. When she kissed me, I did not mind at all.
Chapter 4. Wherever they travel, in the Atlantic, the North Pacific, the Bering Sea, when it is time to leave the great oceans and go home to spawn, salmon have the ability to find their way back to the river of their birth. It is thought that they use magnetoreception. Off he goes! To locate the general position of their river. And when they're nearly there, they switch to their sense of smell to locate the river entrance and from there, the spawning ground where they were conceived. Listeners, block your ears! Even bacteria can have this magical ability to turn themselves into active living maps. In these cases, the bacterium demonstrates a behavioural phenomenon known as magnetotaxis, in which it orients itself along the lines of the Earth's magnetic field. And you have nothing to lose but your smoker's cough. It is reasonable to assume that Buckhuber the navigator might have had a skerrick of magnetotaxis in his bones, but my experience suggests the opposite. For I had been accidentally delivered to my spawning ground, and did not see or smell or even feel it. I had no clue. I was irritated and unsettled by these confident references to my race. I feared Carter and his rum. I was afraid of the loneliness, the dust and dirt, the red-rutted roads emerging from the spinifex and acacia, the scalded soil. The huge diesel generator throbbed throughout my first night. The dogs were never quiet. I twisted and turned, and the mosquitoes bit me, and my gut churned up, and I panicked that I would oversleep and miss my ride in the school inspector's Morris Minor. There was no question. This was the flaw in my human clay, to always flee. But I would not be a teacher again, at least not in a place where they held me in a dusty mudbrick teacher's residence, a pioneer's ruin with a corrugated roof thrown up across its eroded walls. There were plenty of nasty draughts, but none sufficient to blow away the stink of something dead or dying, a snake, I thought. There was angry shouting in the night, then some wild creature scratching at the wall. Of course I wished to flee. With morning, I discovered that my bedroom was a storehouse stacked with a jumble of old motors and all sorts of scrap. I found the outhouse, which had eluded me all night, picked up my luggage, and carried my fake belongings, the crumpled newspaper and pencil sharpener, out into the weary air to face that single limestone bluff, the survivor of 400 million nightmare years. I know. Life was all around me, and I was a white man, a Cartier, who saw only death. I rushed through a failed plantation of species I did not know, and, having contrived to open an ingenious gate, arrived at Carter's front veranda. The concrete slab, which had been wet and clean when first I saw it, was now littered with beer cans and broken glass, and it was from this chaos I beheld Carter rising slowly to his feet. He was unshaven, of course, and his yellow hair was a nest of broken straw, but he tugged his trousers up above his hips and looked down his parrot nose at me, and I understood, in that moment, the status of a schoolteacher on Quamby Downs. I did not see the cricket ball, nor did he intend me to. "Catch!" he cried, and flung it hard. "How's that?" Lord, it stung my hands, but I returned it casually, as if assaults were nothing to a man like me. "I wanted a natter with Mr. Hanger." "Gone, mate," he said, considering me in a more friendly manner. "No," I said, "he's going to get his brakes fixed before he leaves." "He said the exact same thing to me, mate," he said, hamming up his response to this coincidence. "That was our point of contention, now you mention it. Fucking amazing. I said to him, 'What do you think this is, a service station?' Of course, he's a servant of the Queen, and I don't mind feeding him and all the grog he wants, but I've got a business, and he wants a free mechanic. I've got two mobs on their way to Broome, 500 beasts, 8 miles a day, 5 men to a mob. You know how many windmills we lost in the last wet? That's my bloody day, mate, putting oil in windmills, and not a useful man left here." "Where is Mr. Hanger?" "I didn't see the point of detaining him. He left you this to mail to Perth. Good luck with that, mate." It was a contract for me with the Education Department of Western Australia. Sign or don't sign, didn't matter. Not to me. "It's Sunday. Holiday time today," he said mockingly, using the only Aboriginal language I would ever hear him speak. "What? You might want to give your house a sweep. Go to the store, sign out what you want, and don't complain about the prices. They're decided in Melbourne. Get some Mozzie coils. Set yourself up at home. Ask the house girls to show you the school." "That was a nice catch," he said. "You'll fit in, I reckon." Did I look so easy? He would not be the first man to make that mistake. The schoolteacher's residence on Quamby Downs, like the burned-out Red X car, like so many other pieces of machinery, windmills, generators, wells, so much failed whitefella endeavour, stirred in me an immense melancholy. And this was heightened by the more personal leavings of the previous incumbent, the single dusty shoe by the front door, the open can of two fruits, its rim gone black with feasting ants, the trove of whiskey bottles hidden in his chest of drawers, the wind-up gramophone with no records, its needles spilled across the floor. Beneath the bunk, I discovered the complete stories of the great operas, which, like his dirty postcards, was black with mould, a victim of the wet season. I found a broom and redistributed some dust. I drew water from the tank and scrubbed the filthy sink. I opened the refrigerator and found the source of that sickening smell, rotting meat from which I fled, dry retching. Carter was not at the house to receive my complaint, and instead I was interviewed by the so-called house girl, Alice Thompson, all of 50 years of age, with sharp, shrewd eyes and stick-thin legs. She had no shoes, but was dressed in a spotless floral dress and Sunday hat and pin. "Kerosene been finish," she said, when I had explained the rotting meat. "No, it's the refrigerator," I said. "It's broken. Bad meat." She gave me to understand she would fix it. "But I think you're on your way to church." But church was trumped by white men, it seemed, and when she met me at the teacher's residence, her church hat was missing, and she carried a scrubbing brush and a heavy bucket of steaming water. "What about church?" I asked, although clearly there would be no church, and she would drag out the putrid mess of meat and carry it, dripping, to the outhouse. It was a kerosene fridge, of course, and it had run out of fuel, and Dr. Battery had already been called to do what was necessary to fix it, although, being Dr. Battery, he would artfully avoid any part of that operation he thought beneath him. "You strong one?" was his first question of me, and I thought he was contrasting my indolence with the house girl's hard labour. "I know," I said, "it's shameful." Crabbing sideways in his distinctive style, the good doctor carried a kitchen chair to the middle of the room. "This old leg no good," he grimaced as he sat. "Too many young wife, that fella," Alice said. The old man bestowed on her a roguish smile. "Why, plenty strong," said Dr. Battery. "Three wives," he said to me. "Poor old man," said Alice. "Young Olive been reckon she better get some young fella do the job." This lewd taunting continued back and forth for some time before I understood the subject. The refrigerator could not be easily refueled. First someone would have to shift it to the center of the room. Not Dr. Battery, it would seem. "You strong one, Billy," he said to me. Alice scrubbed the pale pink suds, laughing and shaking her head. But if I was being taken advantage of, I didn't mind at all. I would shift this one, no matter what it weighed. I would follow instructions to scrape and clean the lamp unit. After that, I learned how to trim the wick, light it, and move the monster back into its place without tipping it over. "Next time I fit a hose for you," said Dr. Battery. Of course, there would be no next time. I would be long gone by then. "Put him juice in the tank," he said. "Tomorrow feed him from this side." Alice left and returned with a sheet of plywood, on which she had bread and marmalade and some glistening butter, all of which she balanced on the chrome-legged kitchen table. She poured me strong black tea and added sweet condensed milk. She insisted I draw up a chair to eat and waited until I did. Meanwhile, I could hear Battery going through the empty bottles in the bedroom dresser. I told Alice she didn't need to serve me. She shook her head and grasped the knife and smeared the canned butter on my bread. Her fingers were very dark and dry and worn. She caught me looking, and then suddenly she smiled, and a moment later her whole face collapsed and her mouth opened and she howled. Dr. Battery came rushing back. Alice abruptly composed herself. Something very odd was occurring between them. Battery required I step outside, and I resisted. "Come with us," they said, each of them, together and separately.
"Why?"
"You'll see," said Alice, and laid her wet hand against my cheek. Her smile made no sense. There was no shade, no relief, not even the house garden had a tree. And there was the punkawalla with his ink-black eyes staring at me from the laundry door. A few broken stones marked our path, which otherwise was no different from the bare earth all around it. "Where does this lead?" I asked. I thought, what do they wish to do to me?
"You'll see."
The fierceness of their purpose did not fit the circumstances. I decided it would be convenient to have a toothache, and Carter would have to take me to the dentist, and that would presumably require a town, and then I would get a bus or a ride. I would be okay, I thought. I placed my hand on my jaw, in anticipation of my tooth erupting.
Chapter 5. You went behind my back. I did not say to Titch directly. I did not ask, what do you think I did with him, with Buck Huber? What lies did Dunstan tell you? Are you aware that your so-called mate, the mongrel, pressed his thing against me in the dark? I was your wife, promised until death. You were my husband. You took my money to bookmakers in Craig's Hotel. In the end, there was my sister. Only she to understand. My husband waited in the car, thinking I was talking to our kids. But it was just me and Beverly. We can never see the future.
Chapter 6. Down south, I had been a man of great authority. I had never seen a Gunya, but "off he goes," knew it as an Aboriginal word for a small, temporary shelter made from bark and tree branches, with a standing tree usually used as the main support. In Quambie Downs, a gunya was called a humpy, and wasn't made of bark, but of rusting corrugated iron and cardboard. You could not stand up in a humpy. You could not wash inside. You had no bathroom, nothing but a single standpipe in the camp, sulphurous bore water, pumped by the clanking Southern Cross windmill. In the wet season, the humpies leaked, but then there would be a creek and swimming hole to wash in. Now, when the kids rolled down the creek bank, they came to a stop on waterless sand. I said my tooth was hurting, but no one seemed to hear. The changing wind delivered smoke and the stink of cooking bones and offal, the only portion of the station's beef provided to the camp. I sat in the hot dirt, ashamed of my cleanliness, hoping to never know the texture of that fat-bellied goanna presently lying across the coals. Alice touched my wrist with the back of her hand, and I thought, if not money, what does she require? She stroked my hand, and the kids brought me strip maps from the crashed Peugeot, 62. They wanted autographs. Ah, I thought, so that is it. You write Uncle Reddix, she demanded. And so I did, and who could not be moved by those little boys, their smooth, bright skin, running noses, their hope and shyness? All the camp had seen the cars in the movie-tone newsreels, said Dr. Battery. They had projected the films in that Jesus place, a bough shed with a tin roof and spinifex tied to the chicken wire on the open sides. The projector had been carried in by Brother Max, who showed films about Jesus, but also newsreels, and everyone laughed and clapped at the Red X cars, rolling, leaping, thundering through. So this must be my added value. Proper film star, Dr. Battery said, approximately. Actually, he said something like, him proper film star, or him proper film star, but I will spare you my own confusion." Alice excused herself for second church. I said I had a toothache and was given red sap to chew. When Alice returned, Dr. Battery teased her about her Bible. "Poor black fella, don't have a book. Jesus all mini mini paper book." "That way, Alice? He better than mongrel blackfella?"
"Lucky you, Bullerman toilet," she said. And of course they had known each other all their lives.
Alice rested her Bible in her lap and touched my cheek and pinched my arm and watched to see how the blood fled the skin and then came rushing back. Her own black skin did not act like this, she showed me. That is, we were different. Obviously. Many people came to demonstrate this truth. Time passed, sometimes peacefully, sometimes not. The Punkawalla passed by, a wound-up clockwork engine, stopping only briefly to stare down at me. I put off my toothache. I took pleasure from the children playing. The wind changed and brought the awful smell our way, and we shifted crab-like beneath the weeping gum tree. I was prepared for discomfort and for boredom, but not for what happened next. Imagine yourself a man at his shaving mirror. You know what you will encounter, but then you see not your familiar reflection, but a stranger's head upon your shoulders. You touch your lip, perhaps, frightened to see your finger reflected on a foreign face. Or try another route. Imagine you look into a stranger's face and see your mirror image, except that you are white and he is black. Would you not bite your hand, as I did, or prick it with a knife? Might it not, as my father would say, shake you up like salt and pepper, to see the most demanding emotion in a doppelganger's eyes?
"He been white long time, lie you," Dr. Battery said.
The hair stood on my arms.
"Yes," I said. "He dream for you. He dream for you, to be precise."
Alice was crying openly. Dr. Battery wiped an eye. The doppelganger then spoke to me. If I did not hear him cleanly, it was because I was afraid, and I did not know there could be such a name as his, that it was the custom for half-caste children to be named, not for their fathers, but for things left lying in the dirt.
"Crowbar," he repeated.
"Willie," I said, and we shook hands. Later I would know him as a camp fighter, an obsessive card player with money to invest. Now, as his fearless smile made its first claim on me, I wished I could escape his eerie presence. His smile did not falter, but his eyes welled, as he laid his hand on my arm, and then his slender fingers reached to my shoulder blade, and I could not resist him or move away. And when he arrived at my scar, what a jubilant cry escaped his lips.
The bark at the bottom of the white-trunked trees was like cracked mud, like crocodile skin.
Crowbar embraced me. Alice wailed and hit her head. Battery removed the rock from inside her grip. I thought, what have I done?
Crowbar patted my cheeks. Women hit themselves and rubbed sand into their open mouths. Their faces were intense and folded, their bodies bosomy and broad. Together with lean Alice, they made a choir of unearthly grief and dug into my wounded shoulder as if it were a side of beef.
Dr. Battery claimed Alice was my mother. But, of course, I knew my mother. I said my tooth was hurting. I learned I had three mothers. Here they were,
"But I was from Adelaide," I told them. "No, I was not from Adelaide. That was not my country. This was my country here. I was born at the river by that bloodwood tree." I saw the tree, of course, but I also saw the sand, the discarded clothes, the sorry heap of corrugated iron, the starving yellow dog licking its sores. When the women had released me, Dr. Battery placed his handsome hat upon my head, and somehow that was a comfort. Crowbar instructed the kids to bugger off and the women to be quiet. Then the doctor soothed me as if I were a Brumby who would bolt and break a leg if he was not handled right. "Alice is your mother's sister, so she is your mother, blackfellow way." If I were a horse, I would have trusted that deep, furry voice, the words all worn like river pebbles. Thus I learned my mother's name. She had been Polly. She had been promised in marriage to Dr. Battery's brother. She had been plenty lively and up to mischief like a kid. The boss at Quamby Downs was Big Kev Little in those years. He chose Polly to be a house girl. She was not paid wages, just flour and tea and sugar and calico to make a dress. She had been pretty happy, Dr. Battery thought. She was a proper inside girl. In the cookhouse first, but then in the big house, making beds and sweeping and in the laundry hut as well. Once the missus gave her a Sunday hat to wear. She liked the missus. Nothing bad would have happened except the missus did not like the wet season and she went back to her people for a holiday. Dr. Battery said that Big Kev did not care about right ways or wrong ways. He was the king of the castle. He did exactly what he wanted. He shot a union organizer by mistake, and nothing happened. Likewise, it seemed he had seduced or raped my mother. "Like they always did," said Dr. Battery. My stomach lurched. Everywhere, missionary fella, schoolteacher, didn't matter. White fella too greedy for our women. "Your daddy," was what Dr. Battery called his brother, who was my uncle, blackfellow way, and also my daddy too. My daddy had gone up to the big house to tell the cartier he could not pinch his wife. "I've been Graham up," he told the boss. "Him?" "Your mother. Your daddy grew him up," he said.
"You mean her? He raised her?"
"Yes, yes. Your father grew him up. He put his brothers through law. He mine."
"Polly was his?"
"Yes, your daddy tell the cartier. He mine, he promised one." I will save any cartier readers the inconvenience of learning the convention of Aboriginal English wherein a woman is called he, e, and referred to as him, im. Just the same, the guts of the story was not so hard for a stranger to comprehend. Kev Little was a king sitting on his pearl-shell throne. He was a rapist and an abuser. He said he was so sorry for the misunderstanding. He never knew the girl was promised. What a shame. He had one more job for her to do, and he would send Polly home in the morning and his best wishes, and so on. The next day, Dr. Battery told me, Big Kev sent for my daddy, my mother's promised man. He said he had a sick steer over by the number 60 boar, and he needed his assistance. There were hawks circling far away, so my daddy saw that this was true. They rode 3 or 4 hours to reach the boar, and there was the beast already dead and the hawks tearing it apart. The boss then ordered my daddy off his horse and shot him dead in front of witnesses who would not dare to tell. He never got off his horse, but ordered an uncle to cut the dead beast open and hide my daddy's body inside the carcass. My relations got him later during the muster, when they had to separate human bones from cattle. Dr. Battery's face was like a stone. "By and by," he said,
you was born on the ground. When I was born, I learned, my mother had dug a hole and put me in it. She covered me with a mud of ash and termite mound. That's what they been do, this law, this place. You blang this country. You bright-skinned baby, she make you black like coal. But better be careful. Welfare might come and steal that baby, take him down south and bring you up a white man. Too much babies were pinched from here, said Dr. Battery. There was always crying in this camp. You hear the mothers in the night crying for their babies, and Kev Little come out on his veranda and fire his gun and tell him shut up. Your mother lost her old man. She not lose you, Battery said, approximately.